David Sanger, the New York Times reporter who has spent two decades reporting in Washington, says the Obama administration is the most closed, control-freak administration he's ever covered. According to a report from the Committee to Protect Journalists and the Washington Post's Leonard Downey Jr., in the Obama administration's Washington, government officials are increasingly afraid to talk to the press. He writes, "The administration's war on leaks and other efforts to control information are the most aggressive I've seen since the Nixon administration." On today's Your Call, our last media roundtable of the year, we're discussing press freedom in the U.S. and abroad. Join us after the news.
BBC News with Mike Cooper. The regional East African body, IGAD, says South Sudan's government has agreed to end hostilities, although there's been no confirmation from President Salva Kiir. The regional body also urged the former Vice President Riek Machar, who is now leading a rebel movement, to match this commitment. James Copnell reports from Nairobi.
The pressure is now firmly on Riek Machar. IGAD wants him to agree to a cessation of hostilities and is threatening unspecified measures if this does not happen within 4 days. The regional body also wants direct talks to begin by the same deadline. IGAD is asking the South Sudanese government to review its refusal to release some of Machar's political allies, his precondition for talks. It is not yet clear if this will happen, but IGAD's stance on Machar's rebellion is evident. It, like Barack Obama last week, says it will not accept the overthrow of the elected president, Salva Kiir.
Another three lawmakers have resigned from Turkey's governing Freedom and Justice Party over a high-level corruption scandal. Here's our World Affairs correspondent, Mike Waldridge.
The resignation of the three members of the ruling Justice and Development Party, the AKP, is the latest twist in what's seen as the worst crisis for the Prime Minister in his three terms in office. It's already led to a cabinet reshuffle and a speculation that he may call snap elections next year. Earlier this month, after carrying out secretive investigations into corruption allegations, police detained dozens of people, including the sons of three ministers and the head of a state-run bank. The government responded by purging around 70 police officers involved.
Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been giving a speech at Istanbul's main airport. The BBC's correspondent says Mr. Erdogan has apparently targeted his rival Hizmet movement. More than 100 indigenous people in Brazil's Amazon region have sought refuge in a military base following riots in the town of Umaita. Townspeople accuse members of the Tenharim tribe of abducting three local contractors in apparent retaliation for the murder of a tribal leader. Here's our Brazil correspondent, Wira Davis.
Police in Humaitá, one of Brazil's most remote towns, had to be reinforced from elsewhere in the Amazon region after locals went on the rampage, attacking government agencies specifically associated with the region's indigenous people. According to reports, almost 150 people from the Tenharim tribe had to seek refuge on a military base when about 3,000 locals burned down buildings and set fire to boats on the nearby river.
Police in India say they've now arrested 10 men for the gang rape of a 21-year-old woman near the southern city of Pondicherry. The woman was attacked in two separate incidents on Tuesday night while visiting friends in the city. A police officer who initially refused to register the attacks has been suspended. World News from the BBC. A federal judge in the United States has ruled that the National Security Agency's controversial sweeping collection of telephone data is lawful. The judge said there was no evidence that the government had used any of the data it had collected for any reason other than to investigate and disrupt terrorist attacks. A powerful bomb in the Lebanese capital Beirut has killed five people, including Mohammed Chatta, a former Lebanese finance minister close to Lebanon's anti-Syrian alliance. The state news agency said more than 50 were injured in the suspected car bomb attack. Mr. Chatta was an advisor to the former Prime Minister, Saad al-Hariri, who implicitly blamed the Syrian government's Lebanese ally Hezbollah for the killing. Hezbollah has described it as a heinous crime and an evil attempt to destabilise the country. The Lebanese opposition MP, Bassem Chab, says he believes that the fates of Lebanon and Syria have become almost intertwined.
The fight for the regime in Syria has also become a fight for Lebanon, which means that basically we have to wait until things are resolved in Syria before things quiet down here. And I'm afraid that this may not be an isolated incident.
A car bomb has exploded in the town of Pyatigorsk in the North Caucasus region of Russia. The blast took place outside a police building. In a statement, the police said half of the building was destroyed. Unofficial police sources said at least two people were killed. No details have emerged about who might have carried out the bombing. The Zimbabwean ambassador to Australia, Jacqueline Zwambila, has applied for asylum there, saying she will not return home when her term ends next week because she fears for her safety. In an interview given to the Canberra Times, Ms. Zwambila, who is politically aligned to Morgan Tsvangirai's Movement for Democratic Change, said that Zimbabwe's national elections earlier this year were stolen by the current government, which she describes as illegitimate. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 2013 was the second worst year on record for jailed journalists. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Turkey, Iran, and China accounted for more than half of all journalists imprisoned around the world this year. 211 journalists have been jailed for doing their work. Journalists have also been jailed in Eritrea, Vietnam, Syria, Azerbaijan, Ethiopia, Egypt, and Uzbekistan. The committee has sent letters expressing serious concerns to each country that has jailed a journalist. In the past year, advocacy led to the early release of at least 39 imprisoned journalists around the globe. The Committee to Protect Journalists is also out with a report by the Washington Post's Leonard Downey Jr., focusing on leak investigations and surveillance in a post-9/11 America. And it found that in the Obama administration's Washington, government officials are increasingly afraid to talk to the press. David Sanger, veteran chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times, said, quote, "This is the most closed, control-freak administration I've ever covered," end quote. So how are reporters dealing with this? How should they? And how is this affecting the free flow of information? On today's Your Call, it's our last media roundtable of the year, and we're talking about the top stories of the year and press freedoms here in the U.S. and around the globe. And joining us is Paul Mooney, an award-winning freelance journalist who has reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. He is the author of four travel books on China and Taiwan. China recently refused to give Paul a visa to return to Beijing to work as a features writer for Reuters. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Great to have you. Mark Seibel is the chief of correspondence and foreign editor for McClatchy Newspapers, which includes the Fresno Bee, Merced Sun Star, and the Sacramento Bee. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And Robert McChesney is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is the author of several books on the media. His most recent is Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Robert is also co-founder of Free Press, a national media reform organization. Hi, Bob. Welcome back.
My pleasure, Rose.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off the show on a positive note, giving kudos to a journalist who did a good job this week. But because this is our last show of the year, I just wonder what stories you consider to have been the most important ones of the year. And the NSA has been getting a lot of attention. So maybe if we can't mention that one until later in the show, that would be great. So, Mark, why don't we start off with you? What were some of the most important stories this year?
Well, the NSA really does eclipse much of what happened during the year. But I'm going to mention a couple other well-known things. I think the whole controversy over Benghazi is interesting, mostly because I think it is an example of where nobody wants to probe very deeply at what the real issues are. And we've gotten a lot of discussion of the specific what took place during the attack, but not much discussion of the policy that led us to be into a situation where a previously stable country was destabilized by our own actions and how that came about. Of course, neither the Republicans or the Democrats would like to talk about that because they're both guilty.
Well, and just on this issue, since you say that nobody has really probed, what role should reporters be playing at a time when the Dems and the Republicans don't want to talk about it? Because What reporters often tell us, and I know that it angers our listeners, is that D.C. really sets the tone. And if the politicians aren't talking about it, well, then the reporters don't write about it. So what could a reporter do in this instance? Or should a reporter do?
I think a reporter could engage in some critical thinking, wonder how we got to the stage we're at, and then ask questions about it and begin probing at it. I don't think a reporter... In fact, this is a problem I have with much of the journalism we do, even some of what we call investigative journalism. We're waiting for some official or some person to drop a piece of information on us instead of looking at the world as it exists and say, I wonder what happened here, and then go out and get the answers to it. And that's true in our Syria policy. I don't think anybody's asked any hard questions about how Syria policy came to be the mess it is now. And, you know, it's not really a question of waiting for some official to talk about it or some elected politician. It's a question of figuring out what the issue is, or at least what is an unexplored aspect of that issue, and then exploring it.
And on that note, Paul, I just want to bring you in because you've reported from China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. So what would you say to Mark's point? And what happens when the U.S. takes a big trip, for example, to China? I mean, how do you probe in this case just to get beyond the talking points and what the politician wants you to focus on?
Right. Well, you know, in China, I've been dealing with this for 18 years. The government never talks to anyone. And, you know... So I've learned to be creative, and I found that if you dig hard and if you do your homework, you can always find people that are willing to talk. You don't have to just rely on, you know, on government officials or people working in the government. There's always people that you can, you know, in academia or in political parties or think tanks. You can always find people who will talk. I think it's, you know, you can't wait for the government to give you an opportunity. You have to work around that kind of restriction.
And Mark, you wanted to include a few more of your highlights for this year?
Well, I'm going to mention one other because I think everybody has forgotten about it, and that's the explosion April 17th in West Texas, which killed 12 people and really leveled a town of about 3,000 people. It was a fertilizer explosion. Now, it had the timing misfortune of occurring at the same time that we were all paying attention to the Boston Marathon bombings. But it was actually an enormous news event. The basic beginnings of the event, you know, obviously were covered, hard to ignore that. But the aftermath was not covered at all. And by aftermath, I mean a look at what the causes were and what government could or could not have done to have prevented it. And it turned out it's really all about fertilizer. Well, you know, we have a big program to prevent the distribution of fertilizer to possible terrorists in countries like Afghanistan and where we have some influence. But we have done nothing to check on how huge amounts of this same material that we see is so important in terrorist investigations, how it is stored in population centers inside the United States. Hmm. And the only newspaper that's covered that well has been the Dallas Morning News. And they have done story after story after story about how state and federal regulators simply look the other way at unsafe storage practices in our own population centers. And I've always thought it was interesting that if there's terrorism involved, we're all over it.
Hmm.
But if it just happens to be a risk to the general population caused by some business practice, we don't look at it very hard.
And Robert McChesney, is it safe to say that because of the internet, I know sometimes I feel this way because we're so bombarded, that we tend to move on very quickly from stories, whereas before the internet, it felt like journalists spent a lot more time doing a lot more follow-ups. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think that's true to the extent that all the electronic media developments, starting going back to 24-hour cable news channels, have given this necessity to keep something fresh on the air to keep people coming back. So I think there's that bias possibly built into it. But, you know, I don't think that is a major, that's not a determinative factor in what harms journalism, in my view.
So why do you think such a very important story like this one, why hasn't there been more follow-up? Because the only way to really change this, when you're looking at policy, is to shame politicians into doing something, and that's what journalists' role is supposed to be. I mean, you've got great reporting at the Dallas Morning News, but there needs to be more than that.
You know, one of the great problems that journalists face, and the two guests I'm honored to share the program with today are glorious exceptions to this, but the difficulty that journalists oftentimes face, and they've already talked about this, is that when people in power don't want to talk about something, it puts journalists in a difficult position at times covering a story because they don't necessarily get as much approval, they don't get the go-ahead, it's not taken up as a serious story if there's sources talking that much, official sources. And I think that's one of the factors that really determines a lot of what we see in the news and what we don't see in the news and how we see it.
And Mark, has any McClatchy reporter stayed on this story? And how do you determine whether or not to put the resources into one reporter to continue on one topic?
Well, of course, resources is always an issue. And I will say that from a McClatchy standpoint, we have not followed the West Texas story as well as say, the Dallas Morning News has. It's always, you know, you always are looking for where the approach is that works for your readership. And that's part of the issue. I would say that, you know, we've been much better at looking at some of the other things, the Benghazis, the Syrias, even the NSA, than we have looking at West. And part of that is the way we're set up to examine certain kinds of issues, and we don't really have expertise in other areas.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because it gave me an idea to do a series maybe in January where we take a week and take a look back at 2013, the biggest stories, and then look at where we are now. I think that would be a really great series. And what about you, Paul Mooney? What were some of the highlights for you this year in journalism?
Well, you know, I focus on China, and, you know, this has been a bad year for the media, for social media, for the Internet in China. We have a new government. It came into power about a year ago, and they cracked down very hard on freedom of expression. And there have been a lot of reports on individual cases, a blogger being arrested, you know, newspaper, you know, journalists being, you know, fired, things like that. But I don't think anyone's really, I don't think many people have connected the dots that kind of show that there's a massive change going on in China and that it's heading in a really kind of bad direction. So, you know, but, you know, I just feel like that, and I don't even think that maybe even some U.S. government officials or business people or academics are kind of onto this. I think there's a very dangerous trend that's going on in this government's attempt to kind of really control. They're stepping back 20 years now.
Wow. So tell us more about that. What massive changes are you seeing?
Well, you know, basically, you know, we had a new government come in. I think on the one hand, you know, China's feeling very powerful and confident now. They don't really worry necessarily about what the world thinks about them. They're also under siege. We have 127 people set fire to themselves in Tibet. We have, you know, farmers demonstrating, factory workers. We have violence in Xinjiang, northwestern China, where there's a Muslim population. And I think the government hasn't been dealing with these issues. They deal by kind of using more repression. And so they feel that they're under siege, and they forget that we're just the messengers. So they've gone after the foreign media. There are 23 reporters from Bloomberg and the New York Times now who may not get their visas. My visa was refused this year. So China's trying to control the dialogue, but they can't do it anymore. The Internet has become too powerful, and you know, basically the media, even the Chinese journalists, are refusing to bow to this type of pressure.
What is the state of the media in China?
If you're talking about the foreign media, well, it's the worst situation it's been in the 18 years that I was in China.
Wow.
I've never seen this many people have trouble getting visas before, and it's definitely intimidation. And on the Internet, we have what they call Big V, these VIP bloggers, very influential bloggers. They've also all been basically chased off of the Internet. People are laying low now. 200 or 300 people, activists, rights lawyers, have been arrested in the last few months. So you have a situation now where people are afraid to talk. Journalists are laying low. But the gap has been filled by grassroots people, normal Chinese who are still going on to blogs and they're finding ways to get over what we call the Great Firewall to go into the Internet. Twitter's blogged, Facebook is blogged, LinkedIn is blogged. All of these things are—they're all blocked. These things are all blocked, and so you know you still have a voice coming out. And I even think that the Chinese journalists and the prominent bloggers will come back again. I don't think the Chinese government has the capability to really keep them down.
Well,
for long.
So now that China has refused to give you a visa to return to Beijing to work as a features writer for Reuters, what's your next move? What are you planning to do?
Reuters said they'll find another position for me in Asia, and I'm waiting for them to make a decision on that. Should be soon.
Wow, that's too bad. And then will you just continue to reapply, and hopefully they might give you one? Or
no, once they reject someone, if some people are kicked out, if you're rejected from returning, they basically don't allow you back in. The normal wait is about 3 to 5 years to be able to apply again for a visa. Some people are permanently banned from returning.
Wow. So you're clearly passionate about this, Paul. I mean, you've dedicated most of your career to covering that part of the world and China. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's very disappointing to me. And I've been doing, you know, Taiwan, Hong Kong, China for the last 28 years, the last 18 years in Beijing. And this was my life. I never, you know, I'm not like other journalists who, you know, you go to, you know, Paris for a few years or you know, or Tokyo or Beijing. You know, my whole career has been China. And I've worked very hard. I speak Chinese. I study the language. And I've made a lot of friends. And I'm very, have a strong kind of compassion, you know, for people in China who are suffering, you know, the farmers, migrant workers, AIDS victims. There's a lot of, you know, people that are facing difficulties in China. I have a kind of very strong, you know, kind of, you know, compassion for them. And it hurts me that I'm not able to go back and to continue to do the reporting that I've done.
Mark, does McClatchy have a correspondent in China?
Well, we're between correspondents right now. Our new correspondent, Stuart Leavenworth, who was the editorial director of the Sacramento Bee, should be in China the middle of next month, January. We had a correspondent there until I believe it was May, and it's just taken us a while to select a new candidate.
Do you fear that he or she might not get a visa?
Well, we know he's gotten a visa. He has his J-1 visa, and he's scheduled to arrive. And we assume there'll be no problem with his residency permit, and we'll see how it goes from there.
Well, let's hope. Robert McChesney, what were some of the highlights for you this year?
Well, you've said I'm not allowed to talk about the NSA, and that's the one that does jump out to me as the great story. And I think the highlights to me, though, and again, it's a recurring problem we have with our journalism, is that some of the really great issues that don't have news hooks and that people in power aren't talking about don't get covered, even though in the day-to-day lives and in the future of the country, these are unquestionably the central issues of our times. And examples of that would be the, you know, the ongoing issue of climate change, which is, you know, arguably the single most important issue of our lifetimes for the Americans and the whole species. But unless people in power are talking about it, unless there's an enormous demonstration, even then that hardly moves the chain anymore, or unless there's some sort of news hook, it just barely registers as a news story in our news media compared to its magnitude. Another story like that is the, you know, ongoing stagnation of the economy in the United States, the tremendous downward pressure in wages, something everyone who has children in their 20s is well aware of, that you see going on. As a professor, I see it with my students all the time. And this is a story that barely gets covered, even though there's now a consensus among some of our leading economists, people like Paul Krugman, who writes the New York Times, Larry Summers, of all people, who was Clinton's advisor in the economy, former Secretary of Treasury under Clinton, that, you know, we're in a situation now where the economy is going to be in stagnation for the duration. I mean, there's no end in sight to the current range of debate, with tremendously negative effects for the standard of living, the quality of life, and ultimately for the ability to maintain anything remotely close to a politically democratic and self-governing society. So these are the overwhelming issues people are living that, more or less, if one consumes our news media, you never hear about.
Well, CNN took an interesting poll and asked readers, what do you want to read about? And the wealth gap and inequality was number one. And then, Bob, last time you were on, we talked about the lack of reporting on poverty because it doesn't sell ads. So what do you expect in 2014 for economic reporting? And where do you find economic reporting that really does focus on these crucial issues?
Well, the business press does the best job, but the business press, the limitation of it is that it reports on the economy from the vantage point of investors, managers, and owners, which is its market, and understandably its mission. That's why it's called the business press. And some of that can be very good. It has its weak spots, too, but it has some excellent journalism there. The problem is reporting on the economy for everyone else, for the society as a whole. And here the test in 2014 will be, as the newly forming opinion, I would say, mainstream economists, including people like Stiglitz and Krugman and Summers, and that there is really the era of growth is gone for world capitalism, or certainly U.S. and Western world capitalism. The stagnation is more or less the order of the day, and that has tremendous implications across the board for politics, for every issue we care about, including climate change. Well, how is that going to be picked up in the political debate, or is it going to be picked up in the political debate? How are journalists going to cover that? They have done a dreadful job of covering the economy as a rule, because they largely report what people in power are debating, and this is the sort of issue that's going to require the digging and taking on stuff that people in power might not want to talk about. That's very hard for journalists to do in our society that we need. So I'm not optimistic that it will be picked up, except at best, in the columns, Krugman sort of always being sort of a lonely voice out there with his access in the New York Times, a few other prominent bloggers like Dean Baker and Robert Reich getting after it. But I regret that I think that our debate about economics is still be mired in a bunch of fallacies about the need to balance the budget that are all but ludicrous for, I think, serious economic analysis.
Mm-hmm. Mark, do you agree that reporting on the economy has been pretty bad overall?
Well, I think it's difficult to report some of the issues that we're talking about here because they settled into a series of polemics, because it becomes, well, you're anti-business or you're, you have to hear from all the various politicians on the issue, and the objective reporting is sparse. And part of that is that news organizations have become more and more reticent to seem to be involved in controversial political issues. And of course, when you talk about the economy and stagnation and the wealth gap, then you get into all of the Republican-Democratic arguments back and forth about taxes and wealth redistribution and a number of issues like that. So I would say in general, it is a topic that people shy away from reporting because they don't want to seem to be taking sides in a political dispute. That being said, I think there are some examples where people look at wealth gaps, they look at some serious issues that still linger from the economic crisis, and they ask some pretty decent questions about it. These tend to be sort of one-off series of stories. They don't tend to be the day-in and day-out coverage, which I think is necessary if you're going to have a real impact on the discussion. You know, if you do one series a year on it, or even, you know, report the president's speech on inequality from a few weeks ago, that's just not enough. And you've got to really hammer it home. And I think most news organizations don't really see in the way they present things a way to do that on a consistent basis.
Well, and the other thing is, we often, when we do shows about homelessness, poverty, food banks, you name it, I mean, you know, families living in their cars, we tend to find really good reporting at the local level. So you've got some great reporting, human interest stories in local papers. And then, for example, the New York Times had this massive project called Invisible Child, Dasani's Homeless Life. So that comes up. So it's out there. But what is needed?
No, but I think the problem with all of those cases is that they're sort of they're human interest stories. Hmm. I just think we're exceptions.
Hmm. Well, hold that thought, because I'd love to ask you both, when you read these human interest stories, what about the underlying causes? Because we didn't just get here by accident. I mean, it was policy. So what about a reporter's responsibility to also include that piece in these stories? It's our last media roundtable of the year, and this is a pre-tape show, so unfortunately we can't take your calls. We're joined by Paul Mooney, an award-winning journalist who's reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. Mark Seibel is the chief of correspondence and foreign editor for McClatchy Newspapers, which includes the SACB, and Robert McChesney is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, author of Digital Disconnect. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. It is our last media roundtable of the year. And today we are talking about the top stories of the year. And a little later in the show, we'll talk about press freedoms here in the United States and around the globe. We'll specifically talk about leak investigations and surveillance in a post-9/11 America and how reporters are increasingly afraid to talk to the press under the Obama administration. We're joined today by Paul Mooney, an award-winning freelance journalist who has reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. China recently refused to give Paul a visa to return to Beijing to work as a features writer for Reuters. Mark Seibel is the chief of correspondence and foreign editor for McClatchy Newspapers, which include the Fresno Bee, Merced Sun Star, and the Sacramento Bee. And Robert McChesney is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of several books on the media, including his most recent, and he was on our show a while back talking about this, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Before the break, we were talking about the state of economic reporting. And, you know, every Tuesday we have a show called Agenda for a New Economy, when we focus on everything from poverty to co-ops. And, Mark, before the break, we were talking about, you know, these human interest stories are good, obviously. But I noticed that in some cases, a reporter will follow, say, a homeless family for a week or a month even and say, oh, isn't it great they found housing? But they don't talk about, you know, how difficult it is to be homeless. How did we get here? It didn't just happen. So what is a reporter's responsibility to really talk about the history involved? I mean, you don't really need that much time in a piece to write about it. It's pretty obvious what's going on.
Well, I think that's true. And I think, you know, anytime you embark on a human interest story, there must be a deeper message to it. It shouldn't be just about this this individual or idiosyncratic confrontation with society. It should be something that looks for a deeper message or a deeper understanding of how the problem developed. And I think that's, you know, one of the problems. You know, we're always talking in the media about how do you humanize the problem. And I always worry that maybe we get too close to humanizing the issue without explaining that this is actually a bigger trend situation. Mm. And I think stories have to strive to do that. It's, you know, you don't want to just get this one person, somebody donating an apartment or something, but really confront the issues. And the issues are broader than the individual stories we tell.
What are your thoughts about that, Bob? How should reporters tackle this? Because next year is the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, so we're going to see a lot of media coverage about this. How should the media really talk about this issue?
Well, they should talk about it in the first place. Again, I think the core problem is there's just not that much discussion in the first place. And also the problem, and I think Mark got at this earlier, is that, you know, journalists to some extent are they're limited by what the range of legitimate debate, official debate, is by politicians, Republicans, and Democrats, sort of set the boundaries and what can be talked about and pursued without taking risk that will expose you to all sorts of criticism for being ideological. And there hasn't been a lot of great debate or discussion about this. I mean, Democrats are great when they're 3 weeks before the election and suddenly they sound like a bunch of, you know, wobblies out there talking about inequality and how much they care about the working person. But as soon as the ink is dry in the election outcome, that's really forgotten for the most part. And as a result of that, there's not a working journalist covering politics isn't going to get a lot of really back and forth in any sort of substantive way about issues of poverty that will meaningfully address them. There are exceptions, but as a rule, it's just not an issue that's going to get a lot of attention. And so it makes it more difficult. Journalists don't have the palette to work with as they would if they wanted to write about other types of issues. The other issue I would say, and this gets to what you were referring to, Rose, there is a lot of good human interest coverage, especially at the local level. But the other great crisis that's completely unreported in the news media, ironically enough, has been the disintegration of news at the local level in the United States in the last 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the collapse of the number of working reporters in communities around the country. There's so much less reporting going on. And it's a little irony that I think it was Naomi Klein who said that journalists are the one institution of people who are the ones who should be making the case for what's going on with journalism. They don't want to talk about it. So the public doesn't even know, for the most part. They experience it when they pick up a newspaper or when they try to go online and find coverage of their community, and there's so little there. But, you know, there are just not that many people there to cover politics at the local level, and it's truly true at the state and national as well. But it's especially striking if you live in America, out in the country, as I do.
What do you say to your students about this, Bob? Because, I mean, I've got good friends who are great reporters, and, I mean, they constantly complain about how difficult it is to get pieces published, but then also to get paid for it.
It's the great crisis of our times. It, you know, I write about this. I've been researching it. The decline in the numbers are astonishing. It's not going to get better. The Internet has totally killed the advertising-based basis of commercial journalism in the last century. It's only going to get worse in the coming years. And what I tell my students is don't stop. Don't give up. Insist on doing journalism. Understand the degree of difficulty you're facing. It's much harder now. It's like being a dancer, an actor, an actress. It's not like the good old days 20, 30, 40 years ago when someone could reasonably expect to get a job in journalism when they came out, or even 15 years ago. So it is harder. But, you know, we our society can't function without journalists. So it will be harder. Go ahead and do it. And the only consolation you can tell most students today, young people today, is the economy is so horrible, you might as well try to do something you love because there's not much else out there.
Hmm. You live near a train?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry.
Oh, Paul, is that Paul?
Okay. I'm trying to cup the microphone.
That's all right, Paul. I was going to ask you, Paul, how much time do you spend in the States these days?
Well, you know, I used to come home once every 2 or 3 years, you know, I've been here now for a year now. My visa expired in China a year ago, and so I've been here a year, you know, waiting to return. I waited 8 months for the China visa, and then it was rejected. But, you know, I wanted to add something to what you were just talking about. You know, I've done a lot of reporting in Asia on these same types of issues about poverty, the handicapped, the kidnapped kids, a lot of social issues, and I've always woven in, you know, the background on what the problem is, you know. And I think, you know, if you put a human face on these stories, it has a lot more of an impact. But I've always been very, you know, careful to add, you know, background details on what the government's failing to do or why this problem exists, you know. And the problem I've had in recent years, because I've always been an accredited journalist in China, but I've actually always been a freelancer, I found it in recent years increasingly difficult, you know, to get the support or the funding to travel and do these reports. And some of the what I feel the best stories I did, I paid myself for hotels and airplane tickets because I knew the story was important and I wanted to get it done. But it's difficult, this, you know, with the Internet now and the media situation, it's getting increasingly difficult to do this type of reporting.
I mean,
I've spent sometimes 2 months working on stories, and there's no way you can justify that for a news organization.
Well, it reminds me of when Barbara Ehrenreich said that she used to write about the poor for the New York Times, but then ended up spending her own money to write about the poor. I mean, that just sends such a bad message to those of us who care about these issues. And Paul, as someone who lives overseas but spends some time in the States, I mean, what are your thoughts about how these issues get covered in the United States? And does it shock you when you come home to see that the poverty is increasing, that so many people are on food stamps, so many people are homeless in the United States.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised. You know, I'm staying in Berkeley right now, and I've been traveling to San Francisco, going over visits. And I've seen quite a, in the Berkeley area and in San Francisco, there's a huge number of homeless people. And, you know, I've been living overseas the last 28 years, and so I'm not aware of some things. But I've seen so many veterans from the Vietnam, Afghan, Iraq wars, and I don't understand how this happens in America, you know, that people who are in the military serve their country end up, you know, and all these other people. It's just kind of shocking to me to see this here.
Do you see that reflected in the papers that you read when you're home?
I don't, but, you know, maybe I'm not reading widely enough, you know. I was totally unprepared for what I saw here in the Berkeley area.
Wow. I mean, I hear that all the time from tourists or friends who've left the West Coast and then come back 5 or 10 years later. I mean, they're shocked by what they see.
Right. You know, I was interested actually in writing a story on young people that are living on the streets. It's kind of different than homeless people. For them, it's kind of an adventure. But when I looked online, I couldn't actually find. I'm sure there's a lot written about homeless people, but the situation of these young kids, 19, 20, 21, who are roaming around the country, actually, I wasn't able to find much on that. So, maybe it's because people kind of lump them all together in as being homeless.
That is Paul Mooney. He's an award-winning freelance journalist who's reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 85. China recently refused to give Paul a visa to return to Beijing to work as a features writer for Reuters. And he's speaking to us in Berkeley with interesting insights about what he sees after being away for so long from the United States. Mark Seibel is chief of correspondence and foreign editor for McClatchy Papers, and they include the Fresno Bee, Merced Sun Star, and the Sacramento Bee. Robert McChesney is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and the author of several books on the media, including Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. He's also co-founder of Free Press, a national media reform organization. And it is our last media roundtable of the year. This is a pre-taped show, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. Paul, I also wanted to talk to you, kick it off with you, really, to talk about the fact that so many journalists are afraid, our government officials are afraid to talk to the media under Obama. And I wonder if you keep track of this when you're overseas. I mean, this quote from David Sanger, I think, says so much, veteran chief of Washington correspondent of The New York Times. This is the most closed, control freak administration I've ever covered. Paul, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a big surprise to me, you know, because I don't report in the U.S. I don't report in Washington. I've heard things about this, but I'm actually shocked to hear him say this. It's pretty strong language, and I find it actually, you know, quite troubling that this situation could exist. And I guess I wouldn't have expected it to be under the Obama administration.
Well, according to this piece and the Committee to Protect Journalists, and it's by the Washington Post, Leonard Downey Jr., the report says that journalists and transparency advocates say the White House curbs routine disclosure of information and deploys its own media to evade scrutiny by the press, aggressive prosecution of leakers of classified information, and broad electronic surveillance programs deter government sources from speaking to journalists. Mark Seibel, what are your thoughts on David Sanger's quote?
Well, we've always felt that the Obama administration was singular in its control of information, its inability to share information. It does not allow access to officials for background briefings, except to a very limited number of reporters, one of whom I would have thought was David Sanger. And it's an interesting thing, because I think in a way we enable them to do that, because we are so willing, meaning the news media in general, we are so willing to allow officials to go off the record or to brief us without any identification of who they are. And I would say that, in fact, the larger news organizations, the New York Times, the Washington Post, are particular offenders in this area. And, you know, there was all kinds of back and forth about Syria policy, for example. And it was all not attributed People were allowed to say things that may or may not be true and never have to attach their names. And these aren't, you know, small officials that are going to be prosecuted. These are senior people in the administration, and we allow them to do that. And so in a way, I think we're asking, we're enabling this control of information to take place when we should be saying, well, if you want to say this and you happen to be the chief of staff of the president or the vice president or any senior official, then we think your name ought to be attached to it. And if you're not going to attach your name to it, we're not going to report it.
Is that McClatchy's policy?
Excuse me?
Is that McClatchy's policy?
Our policy is that we do not, we don't do two things. We will take a background briefing. We will not alter quotes after the briefing, and we insist on some sort of identification or explanation of why we're not identifying it. But in fact, we're probably guilty to some extent on that too, though the good fortune for us is that people are not always clamoring to talk to us.
Well, right, you were one of the outlets that actually really questioned the administration on the invasion of Iraq and won awards for it. But Robert McChesney, what are your thoughts on this? Do you agree with Mark that part of the problem is the way reporters deal with these off-the-record conversations?
I absolutely agree with Mark in that. I think the great problem of American journalism, and this is not just recently, this has been a long-term issue going back decades, is that it, especially at the elite level, but really through and through, it tends to report on the world from the vantage point of those in power in the United States, and it accepts their explanations and interpretations all too often uncritically, and the range of debate falls between what those in power on either side of the aisle are debating. And oftentimes in foreign policy, there's not much of a range of debate among those in power. And I think, much of what's been panned off as digging and investigative work is oftentimes just someone in power leaking to a reporter something to push their perspective on an issue or to harm an opponent in a political fight. And that stuff, I think, was okay. The system can deal with that. The problem emerges when stuff is getting released that no one in power is really interested in having the public know, like most of Snowden and WikiLeaks revelations, and reporters start getting access to that and reporting on it, then there's trouble in River City. And I think this is what's going on now, that when the revelations are of this nature, the whistleblowing is of this nature, and suddenly all sorts of information that normally the New York Times wasn't interested in reporting, frankly, or the Washington Post for the last decade, but now this is getting out there, then this becomes a huge concern, because there's some stuff people in power don't think the American people should know about, and journalists have more or less, at the top level especially, cooperated. I think the other side of the coin, though, gets back to the point I was making earlier. I think we're seeing another process going on in the United States in the last 10 or 15 years, is that as the number of working journalists has decreased rather sharply, that journalism is an institution, is the fourth estate, is the sort of cornerstone of our governing system, has lost a lot of its power. It's become more of a special interest. We especially saw this during the W. Bush administration, and I think we're seeing it increasingly in politics. That journalism is no longer really a factor that's factored in like it once was. It's not respected in the same way, and as a result, I think governments feel they probably should have more carte blanche to mess with it. They shouldn't take it as seriously. They're not worried about pissing it off.
Mark, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's really true. And of course, with the rise of the internet, it's quite possible for the White House, for example, to put out its own photo version of events and never allow an independent photojournalist in to take photographs. And that's something that the White House Correspondents Association is currently fighting with the administration about, the lack of access that specifically photojournalists have to this administration and their ability, the administration's ability, really to cover events and put them out and have their version, their press release version of what took place be the only version that's seen by the public. So I think that's a huge issue. I think another thing that Bob mentions that's important to remember is that most organizations have done away with large Washington bureaus. I think McClatchy is an exception. Obviously, the New York Times has a large Washington bureau, the Associated Press, but you know, organizations that used to maintain large Washington presence like Cox Newspapers and Scripps Howard, they've closed down. There aren't people in Washington asking these questions. The same is true in foreign news, of course. You know, there very few organizations maintain any sort of international presence. We're dependent, or lots of news organizations are dependent on freelancers to cover things. And so we're not getting as wide a look at events. We're not getting as many eyes and brains out there thinking about what's going on, and that's a problem, and it makes it weak. But I think one of the things that we've learned with this administration is that they've realized they can go around the news media just as easily as internet startups have gone around the traditional news media, and they're taking advantage of that. And you know, we have to be very much aware that just as the traditional news organizations are competing with internet startups, those that are journalism organizations are also competing with non-journalistic organizations who can put out material that to an unsophisticated audience looks like journalism too.
Mark, just quickly, would you say that the Obama administration is actually worse than the Bush administration on these issues?
Well, worse. I don't know how to necessarily judge that. I think the Bush administration was very unwilling to acknowledge some of the problems it had, and fought back against the news media. But I think there is more of an adversarial process there. I think the Obama administration has concluded that the news media isn't going to ask it tough questions, and therefore it doesn't necessarily have to be responsive.
And that is Mark Seibel, Chief of Correspondence and Foreign Editor for McClatchy Newspapers. Paul Mooney is an award-winning journalist who's reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since 1985. China recently refused to give Paul a visa to return to China to work as a features writer for Reuters. And Robert McChesney is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's our last media roundtable of the year. This is a pre-taped show, so sorry we can't take your phone calls. I wanted to also talk to all of you about analyzing the news, because we often get emails from listeners who say, please do a show about critical analysis. What does that mean today? And I think it's so important in this age of opinions, because a 2011 report by the American Journalism Review found that the number of foreign correspondents employed by U.S. papers decreased drastically since 2003. And there was this interesting piece in Policy Mike about the New York Times recently announcing that it would bring in a dozen international op-ed writers as it reintroduces the International Herald Tribune as the International New York Times. They did this just a couple weeks ago. And so I just wonder what you all think about this increasing move to, people op-ed writing and people sort of using their soapbox in a very personality-driven way. Paul, first off, what are your thoughts on the New York Times bringing in so many op-ed writers to focus on international issues?
I guess I worry because then you don't have as many people on the ground. Although the New York Times, you know, their bureau in China, their bureaus in China are quite well-staffed, they're big. They've recently started something called Sinosphere, which has people, you know, reporting on breaking news. But it's you know, a lot of it's done from Hong Kong, outside of China, and it's not old-fashioned reporting. It's not pounding the sidewalks. And so I see that as kind of a bad trend. We're moving away from having people on the scene, reporting and you know, just doing old-fashioned reporting.
And Bob, what are your thoughts on this move toward opinion, and what does this mean for our ability to analyze what's going on?
I'm all for opinion and opinion-based work. That's what academic scholarship is, basically, at its best. It's strong arguments backed up by evidence. But the problem is that the evidence is crucial for that type of journalism work, and the evidence is the sort of journalism that goes out and digs and finds stuff and checks facts and has competitive newsrooms, so if you miss it, someone can call you on it. And the sort of bloviating that goes on for op-ed type stuff sometimes does that. There's some great columnists, don't get me wrong, but it's also very easy for it to generate into just sort of nonsense. One of the things my research showed or demonstrated or I learned from it, I don't want to say I came up with it to be really accurate, is that, you know, people think of Fox News on television, that its great contribution, so to speak, to American journalism or the great development it ushered in was partisan television journalism, where you would basically take a political viewpoint and generate an audience around those politics. And that was sort of the theory. And that's a lot of truth to that. But really the other side of that that's not talked about as much is what Fox News realized is that if you get rid of all your reporters and don't spend any money in actually covering anything, you can give the facade of journalism just by having charismatic blowhards give their opinion. And, you know, and that's exactly what they do. And I actually interviewed the former head of CNN in 2000, who was basically criticized by his bosses at Time Warner for not being willing to lay off, close newsrooms and lay off a lot of his staff and just go to the bloviate model that Fox News is doing, because it was so incredibly profitable as a form of journalism.
You know, I have to laugh because Megyn Kelly on Fox News said that Santa and Jesus are both white, and that story got more attention than the details of the last budget on Facebook. I mean, everybody was posting it. Even very political junkie friends were posting this. And it's just so bizarre to watch this.
Well, you're right. And this is the sort of, so it's hard to get excited that this is really the sort of journalism we need. Again, having a sort of debate, with people giving their ideas and saying opinions that might seem inane, certainly there's nothing wrong with that. If you're doing it on a foundation of people actually covering stuff, reporting on stuff, getting after stuff, but without it, it becomes bread and circuses. It becomes asininity.
All right, so we're almost out of time, and I don't want to end on a note about Fox News for our last Friday show of the year, but where are you hopeful about 2014, just quickly? Bob, what are you looking forward to next year in journalism?
Well, I think journalism will respond to politics to a large extent. If there are hopeful developments politically that expands the range of what politicians are talking about, what's being talked about in political culture, it opens space for journalists in the United States to do more interesting work, gives them more leverage to do great stories. And so am I optimistic about American politics is really the way I would frame the question. And I tend to be very optimistic in the medium to long term. I'm not as optimistic in the near term. I don't think 2014 is going to necessarily be a great year. But the one thing I've learned in my life is prediction is an impossible business. And I will gladly be proven wrong, and I hopefully will be.
Mark, just quickly, your predictions, 2014? Or hopes?
Well, I think we haven't talked about the NSA at all in this hour, but I think one of the most exciting developments is we're about to see the first nonpartisan fight in Washington over American policy in a very long time. And I think it will be interesting to see how the coalitions develop there, because this is the first issue that I can think of where the Democrats and the Republicans find themselves on the same side, both sides of that discussion.
Well, we'll definitely...
And that's a fascinating, fascinating dynamic.
Yeah, and you know, we'll bring that up in our next couple of shows. Paul Mooney, an award-winning journalist who's reported from China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. Mark Seibel, chief of correspondents for McClatchy, and Bob McChesney, professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thank you all for joining us. Thanks so much for your work.
Thank you, Rose.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And thanks so much for listening. Happy New Year. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
What are the reasons for the obesity crisis in the U.S.? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Dr. Deborah Cohen, author of A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Forces Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. 2 out of every 3 adult Americans are either overweight or obese. When did Americans start putting on the weight? And what does it take to end the epidemic of obesity in the U.S.? Join the conversation with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.